time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today. Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
I've never seen any sign of anything like this going on, you know.
I still want to walk, you know. I don't want to be intimidated to stop and change my routine.
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
My name's Ed, and for the past two decades, I've been producing true crime content for some of your favorite networks like Hulu, Oxygen, and of course, Investigation Discovery.
And I'm Melissa, Ed's bestie and walking, talking true crime database.
We've combined my behind-the-scenes insight with Melissa's morbid curiosity to bring you a podcast that immerses you in the true crime genre like never before.
We highlight victims' cases and bring you exclusive insight from the people who lived through them, with a touch of humor to lighten even the darkest stories.
This is Murder Unscripted.
Dun, dun, dun.
What is happening, crime crew? Welcome to episode 78 of Murder Unscripted, the podcast that brings you inside the raw, unfiltered world of true crime. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, here with the woman who I can only assume spends her Thanksgiving quietly eating stuffing in the corner, Melissa Spivey.
I don't eat stuffing. Mashed potatoes, maybe. I'm known to hoard them.
Well, Melissa, as you and our listeners know, we have spent the last few weeks talking about cases where forensic artistry has played a role in solving a crime. And you've covered two incredible stories that were essentially solved with composite sketches, the Ottawa murder of Ardeth Wood and the crimes committed by that super pervert who also may be America's least known serial killer, Daniel Lee Corwin.
He was the worst, but also, yeah, least known. Like, it will never cease to amaze me that some of these serial killers become household names, while other ones who are like just as heinous and horrible and monstrous, they somehow fly under the radar. I don't get that.
Yeah, and the more of these podcasts that come out, everybody's covering everything now. I feel like more people are going to hear about these lesser-known stories.
Good.
Yeah. Well, today is no different because we're diving into a crime that shattered the safety of a quiet California community. And this was a brutal act that unfolded in broad daylight on a busy walking trail, which, now that I think about it, seems like a super troubling theme this month. Like, I don't think we meant to cover all these trail murders, but it makes me never want to walk on a trail again.
I mean, never exercise again. I'm down. That's no hard.
You probably never walk on a trail to begin with.
I'll blame it on Sam. I'll be like, I don't feel safe. Well, before you get into our case today, just a reminder to like, rate, review, and subscribe. You guys know where to go, but if you don't, I will remind you at the end.
Perfect. Before we begin, to truly understand the horror of this story, we need to begin with a phone call. And this is a routine conversation between people thousands of miles apart that suddenly became crucial evidence and a witness to this horror. So it's Tuesday, May 13th, 2003, late evening in Austria. And I'll spare you from doing my Schwarzenegger accent, although it is pretty awesome. But we're in the hotel room of Johannes Lorick. And Lorick was on the phone with his new wife, 49-year-old Kathleen Lorick, who went by Kathy. And Kathy is near her workplace in Concord, California. I'm going to get into in a second why this husband and wife are in different countries, but here's a little tease about what happened. So Johannes, he's retiring for the evening in his hotel room, and he calls Kathy, who is out on her lunch break, and she's walking on a trail. And about 50 minutes, so 50 into their conversation, it's basically nearly at the end of her lunch break. She's ready to head back when Johannes hears a quote unquote low sigh from Kathy, followed by what sounded like her phone being dropped. And Johannes would never hear from her again.
Can you imagine like being thousands of miles away and hearing that and knowing something is wrong? You hear this weird sound and then you hear silence.
Yeah.
You would want to rush home. Like how? Right. And I'm sure you can't get home fast enough.
No. And it's not like you're down the street either.
Yeah.
Well, I know I would feel absolutely helpless, but Johannes was actually home. Like he's Austrian and Kathleen had been making plans to join her new husband in his home country with the support of her three grown children. So we're going to get into like...
Oh, Okay, I thought you meant he was like on a business trip, but that is quite a long distance relationship.
Yeah, but he kind of is too. So let's kind of dissect this. So let's back up for a second and learn about who we're talking about here. So Kathleen Lorick, her name was actually Kathy Aiello, and she was born on August 9th, 1953 in New Mexico to parents Paul and Helga. And she had two sisters. It was Loretta and Serena, as well as three brothers, William, Leo, and Joseph. There's not a lot of backstory available on Kathy, which always sucks, but I do know that at some point they relocated from New Mexico to Antioch, California, which is in Contra Costa County. I always stumble on that. There's triple, what are those, alliterations?
Yeah, the triple C, yeah.
Yeah. Well, in the 1970s, Kathy met a man named Jeffrey Lyon, and the couple married, and by age 23, Kathy was already pregnant with their first child, Michael. 4 years later, a second boy, Eric, was born, and then the baby of the family, Marissa, was born in 1983. And the couple gave it a good run, but eventually the relationship did start to fizzle. And in 1997, Kathy and Jeffrey split up, and Kathy was left to kind of figure out what her new life would look like as a single mom to these three growing kids.
Wow, they were married for a while, too.
Yeah. Well, by all accounts, though, Kathy was thriving in this new role. She had a great home in the San Francisco Bay Area, and she was working in Concord, which was about 15 miles away from her house. And Concord at the time was a growing suburban city in the East Bay, and it had a mixed kind of urban, suburban feel, a lot of parks and coffee shops, above average public schools, and a mix of families, young professionals, lots to do, lots of places to go out to eat, like thriving downtown, just kind of a cool area. So Kathy was an executive assistant at a business called Systron Donner. And this is a tech company with about 500 employees that provided aircraft and missile guidance systems for military contractors. So they made all the little bells and whistles that go into these military operations. Crazy stuff.
Wow.
Yeah. And she was described by her boss as outgoing, sincere, always interested in how she could help. And when you look at a picture of her, did I ever show you a picture of Kathy Lorick? Because the first word that comes to my mind is vibrant.
She's beautiful. She looks like the kind of woman who could just like put people at ease. And she's probably super fun to be around. She looks just like a nice human.
Exactly. And that's how people described her. So they would even say that Kathy, she was in her 40s at the time, but she looked so much younger because of how much she worked out. She took great care of herself, her skin. And people would say she was easily in her 30s. Like if you asked how old you think I am, they would say 30s, easy.
Wow.
So yeah. It was no surprise that she had found love again after this painful divorce from Jeffrey. And I couldn't find a whole lot of information about how exactly she met and fell in love with her current husband, Johannes, who was 6,000 miles away. But I do know that her new father-in-law, Johannes's father, did work with her at Systron Donner. So it kind of seems logical that there may have been some connection. Nevertheless, she did find love with Johannes. And these guys were both super outdoorsy. They loved traveling. They loved sailing. They liked to go out for fancy dinners. That was like their favorite thing to do, was have these crazy nice dinners. But most of all, they loved skiing. And it was on one of these ski trips that they took to the Alps in 2003 when Johannes popped the question. And a few weeks later, they got married back in the States.
Oh, that's awesome. And then she was going to move to Austria to be with him.
Yes, that was the plan.
Okay.
Kathy had the full support of her family, like these growing kids of hers. They loved Johannes and how happy he made Kathy. Like it was pretty much, they were just excited to see their mom find love again.
Yeah.
The problem was they were so far away. So until they could make that big move happen, the newlyweds were forced to kind of live apart. And usually Kathy spent her lunch hour on the phone. And this was because there was a 9-hour difference between Austria and California. So it was kind of a convenient time for them to both talk. And it was something they really looked forward to each day. So something else that happened each and every day, well, at least on the nice days, I'll say, Kathy would strap on her sneakers and she'd spend her lunch break from Systron Donner walking the Contra Costa Trail. And this was basically this awesome walking path, biking path that ran around the area where Systron Donner was. It was a busy trail, about 13.5 miles long. And it just so happened to have an entrance right where she worked. So she could literally go out her back door of the building and get right on this trail. So Kathy and many of her coworkers, they walked on this paved trail that kind of ran around the building on their lunch break.
So it kind of sounds like this was like her daily routine, which unfortunately, as we know from doing so many of these stories, those routines can sometimes make people, especially women, like a target.
Well, yeah, especially if you got somebody that wants to follow, learn your habits and stuff. If you do it every day and someone wants to find you, they'll know kind of where to look.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how many stories have we even come across where someone does something different, deviates from their normal routine, and because of that, they live. Like,
right.
They made an extra stop at the grocery store or something silly, yeah. And it saved their life.
Well, again, these coincidences, the amount of things, the stars that have to align for these murders to come together is wild mm-hmm. to me.
Yeah.
Well, so let's get back to the day we started, Tuesday, May 13th, 2003. So it's around 12:40 in the afternoon, and Kathy is out on this hiking trail. So she and Johannes had been on the phone for nearly an hour. I think it was exactly 54 minutes at this point. And in the court records, they specifically mentioned that the two had discussed homelessness in Austria.
Okay. And
I was trying to like figure out what this meant to the story because they made a special point to call this out. And they say that Kathy lowered her voice out of respect because she was passing some homeless people that had kind of set up shop on this trail because she didn't want them to overhear the conversation she was having with Johannes. And
right.
Court testimony confirmed that she was not ridiculing them or disrespecting them in any way, but she did kind of lower her voice and stop talking about them when she passed, again, out of respect. It was kind of weird.
Right. And I'm sure they were just probably comparing and contrasting the issue of homelessness that both countries face.
Right.
Did you know that Austria has about 9 million people and 20,000 of them are registered as homeless?
Really? Did you just look that up?
I did. I looked it up earlier, and actually about half of the 20,000 people live in Vienna, which is the capital of Austria.
How do you register as homeless? I guess that's a conversation for another day.
I didn't get that far in my research, but yeah. I'll find out.
Well, there were a bunch of homeless encampments in this area, kind of at any given time, and Kathy and Johannes had moved on from the conversation when 54 minutes into their call, Johannes heard what he described as a low sigh. Or an exhale. Ooh. And a disturbance that sounded like a phone hitting the ground. And I'm not sure what exactly this sound was. I don't think we have records of this call. It sounds to me like it was just a very disturbing sound to hear and then silence. Oof. He repeated Kathy's name over and over and over again, but she didn't respond. And with the call ultimately disconnecting, Johannes frantically tries to call his wife back, but there's no answer. Instantly, he knew something bad was happening.
Yeah, that's incredibly jarring because you're like, did the person fall? Did they drop their phone? Did they slip? Did someone get them? You know, there's so many things that have to go through your head if something like that happens.
Well, first thing that Johannes does is he obviously tried to call Kathy back, but he calls his father, Heinz Lorick, who worked at Sistron Donner. And this is how the connection that we think how they met. But he told his dad what had just happened. And when Heinz glanced at Kathy's workspace, he could literally see it. He goes, checks it out. And he noticed that her work shoes were still there because remember, she'd popped her sneakers on.
Mm-hmm.
So he realized that she never came back from her walk because he still saw her shoes there. So when he couldn't find her, Heinz tells Sistron's general manager, who was also Kathleen's boss, that she was missing. And they call the police. And this is about 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Wow.
So Concord police officer Paul Borda, he responds and proceeds to search the trails around Sistron Donner. 13.5 miles is a lot of ground. So he gets on his motorcycle to kind of cover this in a quicker amount of time than Heinz could be able to do on foot. And court documents describe how Officer Borda saw a fresh red stain on the paved trail just as he rounded a corner near this culvert. And to him, the stain looked like it came from bloody hair, like dragging, ooh. I guess like picture a mop, but it's not like a mop swath, like picture a quarter of a mop. That's what it looks like. It's this like S-shaped drag mark down the pavement. Kind of reminded him of like someone being dragged maybe by their feet and the hair just trailing behind. And this mark, it goes from the pavement down toward the woods. So Borda follows this red stain and what looked like drag marks then through the vegetation that lined the trail down this dirt path. And there at the bottom of the hill, he finds Kathy Lorick. So Kathy's still alive at this point, but barely. Like she's laying next to this eucalyptus tree and her skirt and blouse is pushed up and her pantyhose are pulled down. And her face is entirely covered in blood. And the court records describe her as having, quote, no clothing from her navel to her calves. So needless to say, this is a clear sign that she'd been violently assaulted.
This is reminding me very much of Ardith's case that I covered 2 weeks ago. Like, especially at the down at the bottom of the hill. Remember, that's kind of...
It was on a trail, like...
Yeah, and it immediately makes you realize how isolated that both Kathy and Ardith were in the moment.
Yeah, and that's the disturbing part. This is out in the open. Like, where are you safe?
Right, where anybody could be. I mean, that's wild. And I'm sure for the cops who get there seeing a crime like this violent in the middle of a work day on this popular trail, like the pressure must have been on from day one.
Yeah, absolutely. And make no mistake. So this crime scene painted a picture of unhinged violence. Kathy's breathing was labored at this point and her pulse was racing, but her injuries were absolutely catastrophic. She had a massive gash on her scalp and blood had pooled underneath her head, kind of flowing from both ears. And this part was probably the most chilling to me because the court records say her eyes were open, pointing in different directions when Officer Borda shone a flashlight into him, and her pupils barely reacted.
Feel like that's extensive brain damage.
Kathy is rushed to the hospital in the state that she's in, and investigators comb the scene, and fortunately they do find some very important evidence in the immediate area. So lying near the spot where Kathy was found was a 2-foot-long piece of angle iron. And we're talking about something the size of like a baton, maybe, and it's like at a 90 degree. So it's this piece of a fence and it's got holes in it. And I say that because they're able to determine that there's a fence right by the trail where they were walking that had a piece ripped off of it. And this thing is covered in blood, but there's no fingerprints on it. But there's no doubt that it's the murder weapon. I mean, it's got blood on it. It's laying on the ground next to a pile of blood and then Kathy's body. It's like, okay, we got that part figured out.
I feel like it's looking like it's a crime of opportunity.
We will see. So I mentioned Kathy was transported to the hospital, but she didn't make it. She either died in the ambulance or at the hospital at 4:45 p.m. And an autopsy would later reveal that she had sustained numerous blunt force injuries to the back of her head, skull fractures too, including this 13-inch fracture that ran from ear to ear, meaning like this way. So it went from this ear over her head and on her forehead to this ear. And she had severe bleeding on the brain. And the brain swelling that you had talked about, that this might have been a brain injury because of the direction her eyes were pointing, the swelling is what ultimately led to her death, causing respiration and heart functions to basically stop working due to the pressure put on those vital parts of the brain.
Ugh.
And it's clear this wasn't just some mugging or a sexual assault. This was a frenzied act of murder, only made worse by the fact that seminal fluid is found in and on Kathy's body. Basically in every place imaginable, if you can read between the lines on that one. And fortunately, in 2003, DNA is being widely used, at least for a direct comparison. So it's kind of those one-to-one. They had databases. They weren't crazy big, but there were a good, some databases were just starting. So what they do is they plug the sample into said database and they get no hits, meaning the offender had not done anything wrong, at least up to this point, that would have landed him in those early databases. Obviously, they're way more advanced now. But this sample is essentially detectives' golden ticket now, because if they find a suspect, they literally have their DNA right there. It's just need to match somebody to it.
Wow. I hope that during the majority of this attack, she was unconscious.
Yeah. Well, so the Dr. Brian Peterson was his name, so he couldn't really determine whether or not she was unconscious or not. He did note that Kathy was clenching her fists and she was like moaning and moving a little bit when she was found. And she did have defensive injuries on her hands, so she most likely was conscious for part of the attack. Also, she probably felt immense pain. Like, I hate to not say that she went peacefully or something, but it didn't sound pleasant. And the other theory is that she could have been dead, and these movements that people were seeing, that where they thought she was alive, were just her brain randomly firing post-death, right, which it does. And this part is incredibly interesting to me, because Dr. Peterson said there wasn't enough blood on the pavement to account for all of Kathy's injuries. So the belief is that whoever did this, they struck her once on the pavement, probably with that fence post, basically to just incapacitate her, with the intent to then drag her into the woods down by that eucalyptus tree to do whatever he was going to do to her.
Oh, my God. And I'm sure, like, with such a brazen attack, because just daylight in the middle of this public trail, I feel like the whole community must have been in such a state of immediate panic, just, like, freaking out.
No, for sure. So, they wanted... Police know in a situation like this, you need to identify the killer and fast.
Mm-hmm.
Because this was only, so check this out, it was only the second murder in 2003 in Contra Costa County. So it was clearly a big deal. And here's where I want to mention that the police thought this case would be just a matter of minutes before it was open and shut. Because one of the first things that stood out to police was that Kathy was on the phone with her husband at the time, but her actual phone was nowhere to be found. Like, it wasn't on her person, wasn't at the crime scene, wasn't anywhere. So police ping it. And just for the newbies to the genre, the true crime world, pinging is, they basically send a signal that bounces off any cell phone tower in the area and kind of triangulates the position of the phone. And this can be highly accurate, especially if you're in an area with a lot of towers and really good service. And thankfully, Kathy was. So police ping this phone and it's traced to an apartment complex in Frisbee Court. And that's about a 5-minute drive from the trail. So detectives head there with the thought, like, game over, man. We just literally pinged her phone and it's popping up in an apartment right down the street. So whoever answers this door and produces the phone is our killer. Well, not so fast. So Let me tell you about suspect number one, 23-year-old Juan Sanchez. Suspect number one, if you will.
Shut up.
Juan tells police that earlier that day, he was out walking on the Contra Costa Trail when he stumbles upon a phone on the ground. What luck. Here's a cell phone just laying right here. And this is an old flip phone, I'll tell you, 2003, like no iPhone or anything like that. But hey, a phone is a phone, right? Finders keepers. Police are like, finders keepers, hell, that belonged to a murder victim. And Juan is shocked and agrees to actually take police out to the exact location where he found this phone. So he's suspicious, obviously, but like he's also being like, whoa, 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 I didn't know this was a murder victim. So I just thought it was a phone. So they go out to the scene and Juan leads police to an area just 50 feet from where Kathy was found. Like, think about that. He was just right around the corner from where her body was, and he didn't see anything out of the ordinary except this cell phone laying on the ground.
This is why we don't steal. PSA.
Well, they obviously were not going to take Juan at face value here because, like, I hope you're sitting down when I tell you this, but suspects sometimes lie. I know.
No way.
They actually ask Juan for a DNA sample to compare to the samples taken from Kathy at autopsy, and it's not a match, meaning Juan was telling the truth, or so it seems.
Well, regardless, hopefully he learned a valuable lesson.
Yeah. So with one suspect ruled out, they expand their search to the next logical people. And as we know, when someone is murdered, the spouse is one of the first people who are looked at. And with good reason, because how many times is it the husband?
Right. All the time.
Yeah. Well, in this case, we have two. So we have Kathy's current husband, Johannes, who may have wanted her dead for some insurance payout, like some other reason that we don't know about yet. But then there's also Jeffrey Lyons, that first husband who... Was he still angry about the divorce? And the other option is like maybe he hated that Kathy was finally happy with Johannes.
Well, you want to think Johannes isn't the killer because he's on another continent, but that would be the perfect alibi if you're going to hire someone or conspire right. with someone to kill her. I mean, his own father was right there and like he even searched for her. So that could have been part of the alibi as well. No doubt law enforcement had immediate suspicions on him and on his dad, too.
Yeah, well, this was interesting because they made public statements about how the public like didn't have to worry that this was an isolated incident. And it's like, man, I think it's too early to call this an isolated incident because some sort of madman was attacking women on the trail in broad daylight.
Yeah, I don't know why cops do that. Like, I understand that they can't start a mass panic. And that's definitely a risk they take. But it also seems very foolish to be like, go about your business. Don't change anything. Do whatever you want to do. Yeah.
Honest to God, I don't know why at this point it seemed, I don't know if maybe it was really a PR move.
Right.
To just, while they figured things out and they hoped it would be quick. Well, I don't know. But because this block is about forensic artistry and we won't beleaguer this point any longer. So Jeffrey Lyons, he had an airtight alibi. Johannes was in fact in Austria in another country as proven by phone records. And Johannes' dad clearly was concerned for his new daughter-in-law and he went out to look for her and he was on the up and up from the beginning. So we don't even need to go into setting him up as a suspect. He had zero reason to want her dead. They were happy. Obviously, these are steps that needed to be taken. But the biggest thing that jumps out to me is the fact that the murder weapon was a piece of metal from a fence post literally right near where Kathy's body was found. That says a lot to me.
Yeah, that makes me lean more towards crime of opportunity, because if it was someone who like put a hit out on her, was following her, chances are they would have brought something along. Like,
right.
And they probably wouldn't have done it in broad daylight. I feel like that's what not to do 101 in like hitman school.
Right. So despite everything police are saying, like this is an isolated incident, like people are worried.
I can't imagine working this tech company at a facility that couldn't possibly seem safer. And like this trail that I'm sure felt safe as well. And then suddenly this woman's viciously murdered right outside of like the office window.
I know. And I've said it before. Trails are supposed to be peaceful. Like you go there to exercise, to soul search, to just listen to music and freaking walk. And now you got to like put all that aside because some maniac is out there hunting people. Craziness.
This world is evil. That's why we should all just stay home and hang out with our dogs.
Could not agree more. Can't get hurt there.
That's what I do all the time.
Right. Well, do not worry, because we are about to meet some unsung heroes here. So for all the things that police did not have in the way of like hard physical evidence, what they did have were witnesses. And a few of Kathy's coworkers at Sistron Donner had also been spending their lunch break on these same trails, not necessarily in the exact same spot where Kathy was walking, but nearby. And these employees named Gerald, Gregory, and Harry, they happened to see both Kathy and a man who caught their attention that day.
Wait, was Kathy with the man, or like they also saw the man on the trail?
So, no, Kathy was not with anyone. They basically all took earlier lunch breaks than Kathy and noticed a man at some point on the trail and also remembered seeing Kathy. They were basically on her way back from the office. So these were different incidents, but the three men weren't together, but they all reported seeing a man that they thought needed to be told to, you know, that they needed to speak up about. So as I like to do for accuracy's sake and to give us kind of as many details as possible, I want to read from a Supreme Court ruling. And this came out, the killer who we have not met yet, this came out during his appeal process. So I want to read this to you because some interesting tidbits about our witnesses. So around 1 p.m. on his way to work, Gerald saw Kathy walking from Sistron Donner on the trail. She was talking on her cell phone and gave Gerald a smile and a wave as she walked by. Gerald kept walking for 5 to 10 minutes and saw, I got to remember to keep the suspect's name out of it because it says who the guy is. Suspect directly across from the culvert, 10 feet down from where Gerald originally saw him. Suspect held a zip-off jacket vertically against his chest and picked grass off of it. The jacket could have concealed the metal bar found at the crime scene. Like now that the pieces are starting to come together. So a few days after the crime, Gerald returned to the trail and he saw a bloodstain on the asphalt about 5 feet or so from where he observed suspect holding the jacket. And then we get into Gregory. So on the day of the murder, Kathy's coworker Gregory Smyers, S-M-Y-E-R-S, ran on the canal trail. In the beginning of his run, Gregory saw a suspect sitting on the side of the trail idly picking at the grass. So same thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
On his way back, Gregory saw a suspect, again, more or less in the same area. This time, however, suspect stood at a fence near the culvert facing away from Gregory. About 10 yards further down the trail, Gregory passed Kathy, who was walked in the same direction that Gregory ran. The direction suspect faced as Gregory passed was consistent with suspect looking down the trail toward Kathy.
Okay.
So, and then the last coworkers, Harry Agnes Jr., also took a lunchtime walk on the canal trail that day. Harry saw a suspect two times at the location of the bloodstain on the asphalt trail. Second time was 10 to 15 minutes before 1 p.m. So clearly these witnesses got a good look at something and it all seemed to be the same guy.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this alleged suspect that everybody's seeing. So these three witnesses described an overweight white male, roughly 25 to 40 years old. He was about 5'10 to 6 feet tall with medium brown length hair. So obviously investigators needed to somehow blend these eyewitness accounts into a single image. And with that being said, allow me to introduce you to this week's MU MVP.
Yay!
Gil Zamora. And he is a forensic composite artist who had worked for the San Jose Police Department from 1995 to 2011.
Wow.
Now, any true crime fan should know who Gil is because he has appeared on the classic show Forensic Files and a bunch of other stuff. But if you don't remember him from those, perhaps you'll remember him from a campaign called Real Beauty Sketches by Dove. And I'm talking about the soap company Dove. I don't remember what year it was. I want to say around 2012, 13. And Melissa, do you remember this video? Because it sticks out in my mind big time.
I do. And yes, it was. It was 2013. And Dove launched what they call their Real Beauty Sketches campaign.
Yep.
And it would ultimately go on to become one of the most powerful and viral marketing efforts of the decade. The concept really centered around the idea that women often see themselves as less beautiful than others see them. Mm-hmm. So it's easy for you to pick out all of your flaws.
Yeah, it was cool. They were doing these like side by side. Women were like, what, describing themselves and then describing another woman?
Yeah. So Dove teamed up with Gil Zamora and he drew portraits of several women, but he couldn't see the women. So first, each woman described herself to Gil from behind a curtain. Then they brought in a stranger who had just met that same woman, and the stranger described the woman to Gil, and he created a second portrait based on that description. So when the women later saw both drawings side by side, the difference between the two was striking.
Mm-hmm.
The portraits that the strangers described, they looked more accurate to what the woman actually looked like, and the woman looked happier and much more attractive, and like, the message there is incredibly clear. You are more beautiful than you think. Other people don't see your flaws as you see them.
Exactly.
You know, the campaign ended up getting released as a short film on YouTube.
I did know that only because I looked it up for this and I saw the longer version than the commercial.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. It got like millions of views within just a few days. And
I believe it.
It went on to kind of become a global conversation about like self-perception, beauty standards, and of course, confidence. And to this day, it's one of the most successful examples of emotional storytelling, like of all advertising in history.
It's so powerful. I mean, it really does show you that you, how you think you look. I mean, people don't see you that way, that people are, you're hard on yourself. All these women in this commercial were crying, I remember, because they're like, my God, is this really how beautiful I am?
Right.
It was just crazy. Well, I think now would be a good time to mention that Gil Zamora will, in fact, be our special guest next week. So
yay,
and I'm pumped because his process is absolutely fascinating. Like, can I wait to talk to him?
I know, me too. And I actually watched this episode of Forensic Files because I wanted to get a feel for his process, you know, before we started talking to him.
It's wild.
And like, it does seem like what we've learned over the past couple weeks, that each forensic artist kind of has their own way of doing things. And this is not a dig at any other artist, but I think Gil's process is like the coolest. It's so interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So he'll start out by asking like the witness, he'll start out by saying, if you saw this person again, would you recognize them? And this is like his way of determining if they're going to be able to make this drawing happen. So Gil's next step, and I'm sure he can explain this way better than I can when he's here next week, but he tries to put the witness in like a state of deep relaxation.
Yeah, it's almost like hypnosis, but not really.
It's almost like a trance, but it's not. Well, then he'll go on to ask the person to describe what they saw that day. So he'll ask the witness, what were you doing right before you saw or met the suspect? Then he'll like have the witness walk through this interaction or, you know, seeing or meeting the suspect and then everything else that happens until the police arrive.
Right.
So like instead of just trying to remember particulars about the person, he's trying to put them back in this exact space when they saw or spoke to the person. He uses what's known as the cognitive interview method, and it's like a psychological technique that helps people recall memories by focusing on sensory and emotional details. Instead of like a direct question like, okay, what shape was the suspect's nose? Zamora might ask something more like, what stood out to you when you looked at him? Or was there anything about his face that reminded you of someone you know? Or if the suspect walked into the room right now, what would be the first thing you notice about him or her?
Yeah, and that's because that's what you do as a human being. Like you start judging. It's funny because whether it's good or bad, you judge everybody you see all the time.
Yes.
I feel like. So, and I think that if someone has an identifying feature that stands out more than others, your brain will like subliminally, that will be the first thing that jumps out. And that's the first thing you might remember. Oh, there's Bob with the big nose.
Right. Well, and I know for me, I like describing people according to what celebrity they look like.
Yeah.
So when I meet someone, I'm like, oh, they look like Kristen Bell or they look like whoever. And during this whole experience with Gil, he's being very gentle and compassionate. And all of that kind of works to put the witness at ease and to help with that relaxation. So he has a very interesting way of doing things. And he does have a super soothing voice. Like, I want him to read me bedtime stories.
I can arrange that. Now that he's a connection for your birthday, maybe I'll get a bedtime story from Gil Zamora.
That would be beautiful. He's so, like, I feel like we're going to be so relaxed during our chat with him.
Yeah, I'm excited for this interview. But Gil starts by, he puts these witnesses that came forward into this relaxed state that you just talked about to help them remember the details as accurately as possible. And I want to add that although these witnesses, they work together, they didn't really know each other. Like this is a big-ish company, what I say, 500 employees. So these guys are coming up with these accounts on their own.
Right.
So when Gil was done with these witnesses, police were left with basically two practically identical sketches. And the only difference was that one of the suspects described a pair of sunglasses on the suspect's head. So one of the pictures we'll put up on screen, one has the guys look almost identical, but their sunglasses on one of their heads, not on the other.
They do look, they show you that in the forensic files, and they do look
incredible.
Yeah.
So 2 days after the murder, police release the sketches and immediately these become the face of fear in Concord, California. The people are now looking at the guy who mutilated a woman on this peaceful trail. So while police are organizing and fielding all of these calls, there were like 200 tips that came in, by the way. And of these 200 tips, there was a suspect that immediately jumped out to them. But before I talk about this suspect, I want to mention that I've heard mixed reports about how he actually came onto the radar. Mm-hmm. Because one of the sources said that police at the time were using canines and scent dogs to kind of follow the trail of where the killer may have walked or maybe where he exited the area. And that's what led them to this guy. And the other source said that police were comparing mugshots of people that had been convicted of similar crimes to this composite sketch that they had. And that's how they found him. But I feel like it's a combination of both based on what I've learned about the case. So regardless, they start honing in on a man named John Henry Kahler, K-A-H-L-E-R. This guy had known mental issues and a rap sheet a mile long, and it included several violent offenses. In fact, the guy was so violent, he was serving time for attacking a judge who was presiding over one of the cases for the violent offenses.
They frown upon that.
Yeah, don't hurt the judge.
Also, FYI, if you watch the Forensic Files episode, they call this man Mark Fisher.
Who, the John Henry Kahler?
Yes, they call him Mark Fisher.
We used aliases all the time. Yeah. Just to protect the, I think they probably used his real picture though, if I had to guess.
They did, yeah. I just don't want anyone thinking they're going to watch it and they're going to be like, wow, Melissa and Ed have no idea what they're talking about.
Yeah. We would need to make up some alias in our heads. We were in charge of that. And you go to like the record searches that we use and go to Concord, California, you type in your made up name that you did. And there can't be anyone with that name within like 50 miles of the, there can't be like more than one or two. Or if there's a lot, it's okay, because then it could be any Mark Fishers. But if you pick this obscure name and it's like there's a guy in Concord, California with that imaginary name you made up, you can't use it.
Wow.
So.
TV magic.
Yes. All the things that go on. Well, this collar guy, he lived just a few blocks from the Contra Costa Trail. And when witnesses were shown a photo lineup, three of them picked this guy out. So game over, right? This got to be the guy.
We thought that with Juan.
This is wild because they go to knock on his door. And they learned that Kahler had died by suicide on Wednesday, May 14th, the day after the murder. He jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge.
Wow. One day after the murder, he told himself. I mean, and he looked like the sketch.
Yes.
Like, I feel like the police are probably like, all right, that's celebrate, open and shut case.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe though, that's why they insisted that there was no threat to the public, because they genuinely thought there wasn't one.
That's true. And what I didn't look up is what the date of that article was. Like, maybe that was 2 days later after they're like, okay, we got a guy that looks identical. He just killed himself. It's probably the guy. No reason to worry.
Right.
That's a good point, actually. We'll get this. If they didn't suspect him before. So in his house, they find sunglasses just like the one the sketches depicted, as well as clothing that had like what looked like bloodstains on it, as well as a newspaper article about the slaying. So they were just waiting on the DNA results then to come back and prove it. But they really thought they had their guy.
What's that saying? But, if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck.
Yeah, that was the case here. Honestly, but what do you like? You're going to put pictures on screen. This guy was a dead ringer for the suspect. So I have questions about if they actually saw him wandering around. Somehow they collect a DNA sample from this guy. That part wasn't clear. I'm not sure if they got it from his room, if he had it on file or what. But they do collect a sample and they're waiting on these results to come back. But we all know cops cannot put all their eggs in one basket, despite how much of a slam dunk things seem to be. So while they're waiting on these DNA results to come back, they continue pursuing other leads and talking to the other witnesses who came forward. And one of these witnesses was a man named Brian Gomez. And Brian saw the news coverage about the murder, including all the sketches that were aired, and he realized that he'd been riding his mountain bike on the trails that day and may have some valuable information to provide to police. So Brian tells them of a conversation he had with a man that matches the sketch. And Brian had been exiting the mountain bike part of the trails, making his way to the paved part when he encountered a man who asked him for a cigarette. And he stops, he pulls over, has a cigarette with this guy, they chat. And he remembered the man telling him that he worked at a telemarketing company in Walnut Creek, which is about 7 miles from Concord. But he didn't say the name of the company. Brian gave him another cigarette and a bottle of water, and he went on his way. And when police went with Brian back to the spot where he had talked to this guy, they find three cigarette butts on the ground right where Brian said they would be. So these cigarette butts were collected for DNA analysis and compared to the samples taken from Kathy at autopsy. And they match, meaning whoever killed Kathy was the same guy who Brian Gomez lent those cigs to.
I'm going to say it again. Quit smoking now. Not for your health, but you could be a murderer.
You could be a suspect.
You could get framed.
Well, the next obvious step is for investigators to check out this lead about where the cigarette-smoking perpetrator worked, and luckily for them, there's only one telemarketing company in Walnut Creek. So they walk in, they find the manager of this company, and they show him the sketch of their suspect, and the manager's like, oh yeah, that's Robert Ward Frazier. And he stopped showing up for work ever since that murder happened. So feel free to cue the crow. So a background check reveals that Robert Frazier, he's a drifter, he's a couch surfer, a transient, whatever you want to call it. And he's got priors for various crimes, mostly burglaries, robberies, but he'd also threatened violence against women more than once. And since he has no fixed address, cops ask the manager, where can we find this guy, this Frazier guy? And the manager provides his last known address, I guess that was on his paperwork. And when police go there, they find he's not there. And the homeowner, whose name is Deborah Gardner, who may or may not have been Frazier's girlfriend at the time, it's kind of hard to tell from the reports, but she tells police that Frazier skipped town. Huh. Awfully suspicious.
Convenient. Yeah.
Yeah. She's not sure where he went, but she suspects he headed east since he had ties to the Midwest. That's all she could really give him. And I'm going to again default to the Supreme Court doc to give you a sense of what police learned from Deborah and another man that Frazier had been staying with around the time that this all went down. Frazier stayed with Deborah Gardner until May 11th, 2003. Thereafter, he periodically stayed with Walter Backus and Walter's wife, Mickey Jacobson, in exchange for doing yard work. On the day of the murder, Mickey saw Frazier leave in the morning on Walter's bicycle. Mickey next saw Frazier between 5 and 6 p.m. when he walked through the front door as Mickey cooked dinner. Frazier looked very dirty and beaten up. He was scraped and bruised and had marks on his arms and many abrasions on his face, and he was bleeding. There was a lot of dried blood on him. Mickey did not recall whether there was blood not associated with Frazier's wounds on his clothes. So they just knew the guy was bloody. Didn't know whose blood it was.
Okay.
So Mickey asked Frazier what happened, and he said he got into a fight over a cell phone after drinking a six-pack of beer with some guys in a park. And Mickey got Frazier a wet rag, cleaned himself up. And as that was happening, the news was broadcasting about the murder. And Mickey was obviously extremely upset by this, but Frazier, quote, reassured her that she should not be concerned. So that's a little sus.
Yeah.
And a couple of days later, Mickey notices that Frazier became morose and quiet and spent a lot of time alone. And this is the last little piece of this. Walter testified that at some point when Frazier was staying with him in May 2003, Frazier came home at 9 p.m. So this is probably the day of the murder. He just wasn't sure about the exact date.
Okay.
The next day, which was a day or two after the murder aired on television, Walter saw some scratches on Frazier's face and bruise and swelling on Frazier's cheek. It looked like Frazier had been in a fight. And then the last thing I'll mention is Deborah Gardner. So the person that could have been his girlfriend, she testified that Frazier was waiting for them when she got home from work between 5 and 5:30. He looked dirty as if he'd been sleeping on the trail. Frazier asked Deborah if she had seen or heard that a woman had been killed. Deborah did not notice any injuries on Frazier at the time, but she didn't pay much attention. She let him use the shower. On a different day, Frazier showed up at Deborah's house when her friend was over, and he said he'd been pruning trees, and he pulls up his shirt and shows the woman scratches on his back, his chest, his arms, and she jokes, she's like, it looks like the tree won. There's some more details in there, but at the end of the day, Deborah tells police that Frazier left a toothbrush behind before he took off, and she turns it over so it can be tested for DNA. So the only other thing I want to say is all those people that I just mentioned that had like reports of all these scratches and stuff, none of them reported this to police. And it's crazy because I don't know if they didn't suspect Robert had anything to do with this, or they were protecting him, or they didn't want to get involved, or they flat out didn't know about the murder. I don't know.
It might be a little bit of all of that, though. Like, it kind of tracks that people who would allow someone like Robert to hang out at their place might have some skeletons of their own in their closets that maybe they don't want to bring attention to.
Yeah, I wouldn't let this guy in my treehouse, if we're being honest.
You've let me in your treehouse, though. So.
Yeah, for once and only time.
All right, so now they're waiting on DNA results from two people, right? Two different suspects?
Yeah, 2003, too. This stuff is not, I mean, it takes time, right. You know?
Yeah.
So they were also in the process of testing everybody who was staying in these homeless encampments. And I think I read like 42 of those samples came back as not a match to the evidence that they had from the crime scene. So if 42 samples didn't match, I can only imagine that there were probably, I don't know, 100 tested, 200. I have no idea.
Wow.
So, and while they were still thinking this was just a formality because this John Keller guy, the guy who jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge, like they thought that was their guy, but they didn't stop investigating, which kudos to them because they could have pretty much called that over and done with.
Well, yeah. I mean, we hear so often about investigators having tunnel vision, and it sounds like it definitely could have happened here, but it didn't, thankfully.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. I mean, the stakes of getting the wrong person, especially in such a random and violent crime like this.
Yeah. Well, you're probably getting the sense right now that John Keller is not their guy, and the DNA results come back in June, and he is not their guy. So we confirm that.
That had to have been such a combination of like relief, but also frustration for his family to have his name kind of dragged through the mud.
Yeah.
When it seems like he didn't have anything to do with it.
You know, I mean, he was kind of a scumbag, though.
That's true. No, that's fair.
He also had mental health issues. I don't know. I always hate bagging on people that do have known mental health issues, but at the same time, like, they committed a lot of violent offenses. So
I wonder if he was out on the trails that day and saw the attack, or like, and because of those mental health issues, maybe he thought he was involved, or maybe it triggered something in him, or maybe it's all just a tragic coincidence.
Yeah, I don't know, but I know he looks an awful lot like that sketch, which has always been strange to me. It's like, this guy didn't do it? You're kidding
me.
Right down to the sunglasses, and then he leaps to his death? Like, crazy coincidence then. Well, as you've probably figured out by now, the DNA taken from Robert's toothbrush, the cigarette butts, the murder weapon, and the semen from Kathy's body all went back to one person, Robert Ward Frazier. Although the toothbrush did have DNA of three people on it, which was interesting, but he was one of those people.
That's disgusting. Okay, now that I feel like I'm going to throw up. Well, did they know where Robert Ward Frazier was at this point? Like, could they find him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they were able to find him in Indiana, though, through the National Crime Information Center at the NCIC. Not through his DNA, though, but just regular old police records, straight up, because he had been arrested in Indiana for a bunch of outstanding warrants, and he was in jail, so easy to find.
That tracks.
Sadly, he had been arrested in California in 2000 on those outstanding drug warrants, but he was released because Indiana didn't want to incur the cost of extraditing him back to Indiana.
Way to go, guys.
Yep, way to go. Well, so they go talk to Frazier, and he was cooperative and even jovial. And this is like a disturbing interview to watch. Of course, he denies any involvement, but he does admit to knowing about the case. He's heard about it, yada, yada. So investigators are like, well, if you know about the case, then tell us what Kathy looks like. And he describes her kind of, it gets pretty close, but then he also mentions that she had freckles, which is something they felt like only the killer would know, because none of these photos that were released showed any freckles whatsoever.
Hmm.
And digging into this a little further, it seemed trivial, but like all of these articles in the court docs make this sound like some kind of gigantic smoking gun. So it was like, why? But then you realize that the only place she was recorded to have freckles was between her breasts. So that kind of makes sense as to why it's like, okay, who would know about that? Only the person that saw that area.
Right.
Like this guy.
Have you ever seen her picture on TV?
Yeah.
What does she look like? Do you remember?
She had long hair. It looked like brown. With freckles. I don't know.
How did you know she had freckles?
Because I could see it on the TV. It's got a 43-inch screen.
You wear makeup.
You can see it on the picture. Yeah. Yes, you can.
And you can see it on the light.
They ask him then, they kind of are done playing games, and they're like, why would your DNA be present at the crime scene on and in Kathy's body? And he says, I urinated near the area. I was walking around the trails, and my bladder was just so full, and I took a whiz in the woods.
Okay, I went to health class, and I understand that I'm not a doctor or a scientist, but
thank God.
I don't think sperm gets out of one's body and inside to another's body by peeing in the woods.
Yeah, that'd have to be some pretty mystical pee. And honestly, if that's true, I hope there's not a bunch of little high docs running around that I don't know about, because I like peeing outside is liberating. I'm not going to lie.
We don't need any more high docs. We have plenty. It's enough.
This whole interview just strikes me as so bizarre, because this guy is happy as can be. And I think it's him just going over the top to try to be like, I'm such a cool, nice guy. Like, he's chit chatty. It's like a bunch of guys at the bar. It's really bizarre. And he's just like, that was an exact quote that I gave. He's like, I had a full bladder and all I did was take a whiz in the woods. Like, he's making light of this awful situation, which to police is like, dude, we have all this stuff against you. You just don't know it yet.
Yeah.
So they're just kind of watching him dig his own grave. So then on this video, a nurse comes in. She's wearing these pink scrubs. She's accompanied by a detective holding a search warrant for Frazier's DNA. And all of a sudden, Mr. Chuckles isn't laughing so hard.
It's not so funny anymore.
Yeah. So his blood is drawn, because remember, they had this toothbrush, which had a bunch of samples on it. But they wanted to, whenever cases like this come up, they want a one-to-one, 100%, like no questions asked match.
Right.
So they take it for comparison, and it is indeed a match. And when the case goes to trial, the evidence against Frazier was definitely overwhelming. The eyewitness accounts that led to the sketches, they were reinforced by his presence being confirmed near the scene by multiple co-workers of Kathy's, one of whom noted Frazier looking disheveled and acting strangely. And one of his buddies, Zachary, testified that Frazier had actually confessed to him one night while they were all getting shit-faced. So, again, hearsay, but important to the overall picture that prosecutors are painting.
Right.
And the prosecution was led by a guy named John Cope, and he kind of leaned on the savagery of the attack.
Yeah.
And unlike you, I don't give a shit about what makes these monsters who they are. Unless it's like a serial killer like Bundy or something, those are people are interesting to get in their heads. These douchebags are all the same. I had a troubled past. Someone touched me. My parents were divorced. My this. Like,
yeah.
You're one of a million low-life criminals out there. We get it.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously they did. The defense does point to Frazier's troubled past, including childhood abuse, mental illness, substance abuse, and for those reasons, he should be spared the death penalty. Like, they had the DNA, so they were making no bones about the fact that he killed him, but this is why you shouldn't kill him. They kind of framed it as like this emotional outburst where Frazier, quote, lost control when he heard the victim talking about the homeless people, which we mentioned earlier.
So that's why the court documents kept saying it and stuff.
So despite all this outside noise, the jury remained focused on the actions of May 13th and the brutality of this crime and just the overwhelming physical evidence. It outweighed all of those other mitigating factors. And in the summer of 2006, the jury reached a verdict. Robert Ward Frazier was guilty of first-degree murder, forcible rape, forcible sodomy, and finding true the special circumstances of murder in the commission of both rape and sodomy. He was sentenced to death.
Good.
I don't know, we need something for, there were no LWAP. What is it when you are put to death? What can we call it?
Ha ha, sucker. I don't think we're allowed to call it that. Well, the DNA connection's huge. Like, thank God they had that, especially with all the suspects they started out with.
Right, right.
And, I mean, they also had the combination of the eyewitness testimony and the hard science of the DNA. I mean, that's kind of what made this case unbreakable. So it makes sense that they couldn't try to argue that he did it.
Right. Pretty clear cut.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the last thing I want to bring up is that Frazier goes off on the prosecution following this verdict and sentence, which is why I say I don't give a rat's ass about why he is the way he is, because at the bottom line is he never takes accountability at all. Like, you can't ask me to care about somebody who doesn't care about anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Frazier is saying everything that the prosecutor just told the jury about his actions, about who he was, about all that. It's a complete lie. None of it happened. He didn't get a fair trial because of all the negative publicity about him. And he, quote, can't be expected to show remorse for a crime I didn't commit, end quote, before warning the entire courtroom that an innocent man is being sent to death row.
Well, first of all, garbage. Of course he's not going to take accountability. Indiana let him off for some bullshit reason because they were too lazy to extradite him. So why would he think he's getting caught for this? Like,
Deny. Okay, and a check reveals that a now 61-year-old Robert Ward Frazier is still on death row. He's in the California Men's Colony. I don't know where this is, but yeah, he's just going to be there because, as we know, they're not killing anybody right now.
There hasn't been an execution in California since actually that year, 2006, and it's very unlikely that any of the nearly, I don't know, I think there's like 600 inmates on death row in California, but there's a very unlikely chance that any of them will ever be put to death.
Yeah, agreed.
The governor, Gavin Newsom.
Newsom, yeah.
Yeah, he did like a moratorium on executions in 2019. So,
yeah,
like I'm glad they gave him that. And like, I hope the sentence provides some sort of measure of justice for Kathy's family, like especially her kids.
Yes.
But it certainly doesn't provide closure or erase the memory of the violence that, and not only just for them, but it doesn't erase the memory of the violence that is now like that now stains that quiet walking trail.
Yeah.
That the people used to go to for peace and quiet and serenity.
Yep.
You're walking on that trail and it's like this grim reminder of that like danger can intrude even on like the most routine and safest moments of your life.
Yeah, it's true. And I don't know how that trail is viewed today. I'm sure people remember the history of it. I wonder if there's like a little plaque or something there in her honor. I don't know.
Well, if any listeners go to that trail, let us know. I want to know if there's a trail.
Tell us about the Contra Costa Trail. Like, what is it like today? And do people know about Kathy Lorick's murder there?
I can't wait to talk to Gil Zamora about this case because I feel like within his sketches, It would have. I mean, I think it would have eventually been solved because this guy was not going to fly under the radar forever. Like, he was going to get caught for something or commit another felony that would have gotten his DNA into CODIS.
Absolutely. It was no question.
But I think it's so cool how his sketches just take like fragments of memory from everyday people who, and you didn't plan to be a witness. So you're not keeping an eye out for things, but it's like, he seems to break through that part of your brain and it gets you to remember like tiny details.
It's going to be a super cool interview. I want to ask him about the Dove commercial too, just because I think that's as interesting as, I don't know. It's so not crime and so not related to anything, but I just think it's such cool work and this movement that was started because of it. It was just great.
I want to talk about how people gross use other people's toothbrushes.
For all the things people put in their mouth that belongs to other people. Toothbrushes. Yikes. Like, every now and then I'll use Brenda's when I get home from like a work trip and I'm like, I didn't unpack mine yet.
Shut up. Does she know this? This is grounds for divorce. I'm having dinner with her tomorrow. It may or may not come up. How much are you willing to pay me to keep quiet?
A lot. Well, I don't really have much to talk about today, except I need to make a public apology. So, Pam, our research producer, I've been calling her Pam Beeler the whole time we've worked together, which is now, what, 4 months?
Something like that, yeah.
And she finally brought it to my attention after listening to the episodes and said, I don't know how to tell you this, but my name's Beeler, pronounced Beeler. I was like, really? It never came up. I'm just like, she was very polite about it. And I'm like, wow, I feel like a total asshole.
You should. I'm just kidding.
No one corrected me. I've never heard it pronounced. So how would I know? So I've come up with a jingle I will never, ever forget again. And Pam, this is for you. I want to see you out that door, baby. Bye, bye, bye.
Bye. Oh, God. That was beautiful.
Beeler.
Beeler,
yeah.
I'm just happy you put on NSYNC.
It's my tribute to Pam. Pam, I'm sorry. Forgive me.
Pam, you should feel very privileged. For him to listen to a boy band is like a huge deal.
It's a lot.
It was magical.
You should have seen me recording the word lur. I was just in the living room going, lur, lur. And Brenda's like, sing it. And then it'll be a natural inflection. So I'm going, ba, ba, ba. Yeah, but it wasn't pretty. I can't sing. So,
Justin Timberlake, you are not.
That's all we got this week, guys. We got Gil next week. Super cool stuff planned. And we have a cool mini game for Gil all mapped out. So that's going to be how we present this. I have no idea. So we'll figure that out between now and next week.
And I just keep thinking when he says Gil, I think his dog Gil. The other day, he's like, oh, we have an appointment with Gil. And I was like, I'm sorry, Gil makes appointments.
You're like, what's wrong with him? Is he okay?
Yeah, so next week I'll bring a Frisbee and you'll be like, wrong Gil.
I said it to my ex-wife, Adrian, the other day about Gil Zamora. And she goes, Gil's a moron? And I'm like, you're a moron. I said, Gil Zamora.
That's amazing. Yeah,
she's like, what did he do?
Oh, well, Gil the dog is the best.
Yes, so is Gil the artist.
That's true. They are. Must be the name. Well, on that note, that is all we got tonight. Let us know what you thought about this case. And definitely let us know if you've been to that trail and if there is a plaque or some sort of remembrance for Kathy. I would love to know that.
Yeah. And if you feel safe on that trail, like, I'm curious to see people who go there and are like, wait a minute, this happened there?
Yeah.
We had no idea.
Same for people in Ottawa where Artist was found. I'd love to know that.
I would love to know.
Too. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can let us know at the regular places. You can hit us up on our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com. You can email us, murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. Or you can hit us up on any of our socials or our Reddit page at Murder Unscripted. All those fun places. So until next week, stay safe, do stay hydrated, and always remember, perverts, they don't wear signs that say they're perverts, but they do use other people's toothbrushes.
They absolutely do that. I think that classifies as pervert behavior.
That is definitely 1,000% pervert behavior. Bye.